Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode 55.
55 Italian.
Well, always nice to wake up and see circus coverage in the New York Times on the, at least the front page of the website.
Yeah, it's great.
This morning, there was an article about a Romanese family. That means they're from Romania, who have a family circus that plays in outer Paris. And there's just some awesome photos of the company. It looks like one of the daughters does a trapeze act with her cat.
Cool.
Never seen a cat trapeze combo before.
No.
But some really, really pretty photos. If you like the New York Times and you have a subscription, go check it out. It's sort of got some interesting tones about immigration and nationalism in Paris and sort of what this outsider circus means in the community. And it's just kind of a cool article. They have some good photos and videos. You know, the New York Times is embracing that like Harry Potter technique where it's like moving videos or, you know, moving pictures in the articles that are on the loop. So you see some people doing some cool Chinese pole tricks.
That's fun.
But there's actually quite a lot of circus news since we, you know, last podcasted.
Yeah. And our first news is with Guy Laliberté, who is the founder of Cirque du Soleil, but then sold the company a few years ago for $1.5 billion. He's been doing some work in Miami.
Miami,
or Little Haiti, as they're calling it. And it's a new company called Lune Rouge, which means red moon.
All right, sticking with the celestial themes.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this company is based in Montreal, but they're doing a pop-up theme park at the site of the Magic City Trailer Park in Miami. And I think the theme park is going to be called Magic City, which is not a bad name. I don't really know what it's totally going to be like, if it's going to be rides or because it seems like a lot of like maybe installations and multimedia interactive shows. So I don't know.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, he's very much into the theme parks these days, I guess.
He got
another one going on in Mexico.
Yeah. I think the people of Miami are a little, or this area, I guess, are a little afraid of gentrification because it's a low income area. But then it's a double edged sword. It's like, well, we're making the neighborhood better, but then the people who live there can't afford to live there. So it'll be an interesting theme park to follow.
Great. I'm always more for Cirque du Soleil theme parks.
Yeah.
Interesting to see what Guy does out of the context of Cirque du Soleil.
Yeah. And I guess it's on the other coast of Florida, so it's not really like competing with Disney.
Oh, yeah. Good point.
And Universal. That was my first thought when I saw that he was doing a theme park was, well, where in Florida? Why Florida?
Mm.
But it's on the other coast in Miami. Is so far removed from that. I don't know if anyone's ever driven from the west side of Florida to the east side, but especially from like Tampa to Miami, you drive down this like it's called Alligator Alley, and there's no gas stations, and I think they just put in streetlights. It's like it's an hour drive at least or 2 hour drive on Alligator Alley, and you just gotta like make sure you have gas before you go, and you cross over Florida. So it's not like people would be like, I gotta go to Disney and Magic City
with Lune Rouge.
Yeah.
Well, next time we're in Miami or Fort Lauderdale, we'll go check that out. We'll let you know what we think of it. Next time we're in Vegas, we're gonna be telling you about a brand new circus show or sort of circus show, Spiegel World, where I used to work. And we've had previous guest Ross Mollison, who's the founder of the company, on the podcast, is opening a brand new show at the Cosmopolitan Hotel of Las Vegas called Opium.
That's where Rose Robert Lie, Vegas Nocturne, was, right?
Yeah, exactly. So Rose Robert Lie is the theater, and they're going into that theater. And the show that Spiegelworld had there before, which was there for about 6 months that I worked on, was called Vegas Nocturne. I went to the Spiegelworld Christmas party this past weekend and had a chance to talk to Matt Hodges, who's the director of Opium, and get a little bit of a sense of what the show's about. And it sounds to me like it's really got a very strong comedy music angle to it. I think there will be variety acts, maybe less than, say, Absinthe, which is another show they have in Vegas. And space being a real big theme of the project, like outer space.
Seems to be a theme so far, right? We got the red moon, we got the circus of the sun, got opium in outer space.
Yeah, well, apparently someone was like, what's with opium? He's like, opium is the only sort of the theme. It's really space. And I was like, well, that's cool.
Well, I think I read in their press release that opium isn't a nod to, like, the name opium isn't about the drug. It's about an old, like, store that was called the letters OPM.
Yeah, exactly. I think I watched this, they did this sort of, like, press announcement stunt where they had a main character in a trailer and they invited a bunch of reporters to like come in and sort of interact with a character from the show. And he was talking about like the letters O, P, and M and how those letters are in Cosmopolitan and they're also in this and that. And I think it's sort of just to do, it's a little too early to tell what the show is going to be about. Even Ross sort of says that in the article because they still have a whole creation to go through. But sounds like there'll be some cool space themes. You like magic, you like comedy, yeah. You know. Generally trust what Spiegelworld puts out as pretty high quality, so I'm excited to go see it.
The press release photos looked like Breaking Bad. It was like a Breaking Bad theme party with this show Opium.
Well, when I was over at Ross's apartment and he had on his wall like I want to say 30 possible posters for the show. And he's like, which one do you like the most? And there's this one with like a black, it's like a big sort of, it looks like, I don't know. It's like a purple hand coming through black water in a really creepy way. And all you see is like the fingertips and then the word opium like inside the hand.
That's cool.
If you're going to be in Vegas, I think it's as of March 15th it opens. Get your tickets. Check out Opium at Cosmopolitan.
Yeah.
In other news this week / job postings, the New England Center for Circus Arts is officially looking for a new executive director as their interim executive director is stepping down because, you know, interim is not a permanent
thing, yes. Yeah, you read the job description to me, and it does seem like a lot for one person to do, but it also seems like a really fun challenge to take on. And if only we lived in Brattleboro and didn't have jobs already.
Yeah, I thought it looked like a pretty good description for your skills, Lens.
Yeah.
But you're right. New York, I think, is a little bit too far away from Brattleboro. But if you're interested in applying for that job, go to circustalk.com. That's a news and jobs circus website. And I think they have the whole posting there and the way to submit it, all the requirements and various bits of information if you want to become the executive director of the New England Center for Circus Arts. But it seems like there's actually quite a lot of news, just generally speaking, about leadership and management change at a lot of nonprofits, both circus and theater ones.
Yeah. Well, in the nonprofit movement in New York City specifically and in the around the US had a very prominent moment in like the 60s and 70s. And it was when, you know, commercial theater was becoming less attractive and really a ton of money and a hard to get to. And then people were starting non-for-profit theaters and that became like a massive growth in the theater scene. And because of that, a lot of the people that started those theaters, you know, in the 80s or started them. And then, you know, the people who succeeded the founders or the theaters that were founded in around, like, I don't know, I guess the 80s, 90s, there's the artistic directors are still in the role of being the artistic director.
Yeah, to be specific, Manhattan Theater Club, who's been led by Lynn Meadow since 1972. Todd Hames, who's the chief executive at Roundabout, he's been there for 27 years. Andre Bishop, who's been at Lincoln Center for 25 years. Off-Broadway, you have Carol Rothman, who found Second Stage, and she's been running that for 40 years. Neil Pepe, who has been leading Atlantic for almost that entire time, has been there for 25 years. So these people are coming up, you know, on retirement, at least for, not for all of them, certainly, but for some of them, surely retirement.
And a lot of them have their counterparts, which are the executive directors or managing directors. A lot of them have either started together, like Lynn Meadow and Barry Grove started Manhattan Theater Club, you know, in 1972, and they're still both there. So it's this kind of shift is going to come and happen. And, you know, it's like, what do you do when those theaters are recognized by their artistic director because they're the founders, and how do you transition over?
Right. And I think this is, you know, a common story that the circus is actually pretty circus nonprofits have heard and discussed. We've talked about Big Apple and the story of Paul Binder, Smirkus and the story with Rob Merman, NECA and the story with Elsie and Serenity, Pickle Family Circus, and Larry Pizzoni. It's a pretty common story of these artistic directors, and once you become a nonprofit, sort of what happens with that management style. But now, actually, there's a lawsuit being brought by Randy Arnold against the Geffen Playhouse, where he was the artistic director for 17 years, basically suing the board for pushing him out of the theater unfairly or, you know, without due cause. So I think whatever happens to that lawsuit will be very interesting, because if it ends up being in Randall's favor, there may be some interesting legal precedents that are set about what really can happen when you're kicking out an artistic director.
Yeah, as the article says, not very many people would comment on this, that they asked for, you know, a quote, because it is such a touchy subject. But two people that did speak about this are actually the managing director and the artistic director of Atlantic Theater Company, which we are both involved with. And Neil Pepe, who is the artistic director, who is the, you know, started the company with his wife, Mary, you know, 25 years ago. I think what he said is so true. Like, what he says is, as hard as it can be, our job is to constantly be learning, listening, looking around, and evolving. That's hard. Your instinct is to want to preserve and lock down. But the point where it feels like it's about trying to preserve success, where it's atrophying, then I would think all the people around us would say, it's time to move on. And I do get that vibe, right, from a few theaters where it's like, oh, it's always the same thing. They're still doing the type of work that they did however many years ago. And the problem with nonprofits is, even when, you know, because we're on the board of a few, they're so used to doing things how they've always done it for years and years and years and years and years, and they don't want to change. And that's just, like, not how life works. You have to evolve. You have to change with the times and, like, what audiences are wanting. And also what the demands of, like, a school, a nonprofit school, you know, what the students are needing.
Well, that's a good transition, actually, because there's another article this week about nonprofit theater schools in New York City and how they're all getting priced out of Manhattan. And this was, I thought, particularly interesting because my understanding is that, like, back in the 70s and 80s, all you would go and do is, like, take a class with some, like, semi-famous actors or acting teachers at a little studio in Chelsea. And over time, institutions like NYU and Juilliard and the New School have developed these, like, really intense accredited acting programs. And simultaneously, the rents have been rising in Manhattan, particularly in the Chelsea area and the Soho area, where there are a lot of these theaters. And these schools are basically, like, no longer able to compete. And by schools, I mean, like, independent acting schools. And that's not something you really see in circus. Granted, you don't see, like, big schools in Manhattan. You see stuff more in Brooklyn and Queens, and we'll definitely talk about that later today with our guest, Susie Winston, who runs Circus Warehouse, which is in Queens. But it's an interesting problem that circus doesn't yet have, and maybe one day, if programs are getting accredited with universities and there was some kind of tie-in, we'd see that. But in this case, it's just interesting to watch what's happening with these acting studios and which ones are going to survive. No comment.
Well, I think there's a lot of acting schools. There might be too many. So it's probably good to weed out a few of them. I mean, there's like an acting studio on every like block, it feels like.
It does seem that way. The one Spencer Novick takes classes with, I forget his name, was the one article that was like, this is the dude who's the new successful guy because he has his studio at Industry City in Brooklyn, and all his young students, like, you know, Spencer's a fairly young guy, don't mind going to Brooklyn, and it's not all about, like, going where
Manhattan.
People, famous celebrity actors used to train.
Right. Yeah, I also think acting is kind of one of those things that you can either do it or you can't, and you can either, you know, work on it if you can, but I don't know if you can really be taught to act.
I'm sure you can talk to act better, but I think you're right. I don't think if you're not going to become a Broadway star if you don't already have that in your genes.
Right.
Well, that's actually a pretty good transition to our guest today, Susie Winston, who is the co-founder and director of Circus Warehouse, which is an elite pro-level training circus facility in Long Island City. That's Queens. She was also a very accomplished ballet dancer, has been in multiple Broadway shows and national tours of shows. She's published books of poetry. She's had a super interesting career. I think anybody who's interested in multidisciplinary artists, what it's like to run a circus school, what it's like to go from dance to circus, interest will be super interested in this episode.
But before you listen to our podcast, or after you listen to the podcast, make sure to rate us on iTunes, subscribe on iTunes, like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, Twitter tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com.
Here's our interview with Susie. Susie, where did you grow up?
I'm from New York.
The city of New York?
I was born in the Village, and my parents moved to Queens and bought, you know, the first house, and they were, you know, young artists, and my father had a typesetting business, and so I grew up in Queens and then moved to New Jersey, and then I sort of blotted out the whole New Jersey experience by coming into the city every day to do class at Joffrey and ABT when there used to be open studios in New York.
So dance classes?
Ballet class.
Ballet classes.
It was all about ballet.
What did you like about ballet when you were, like, starting it?
I think it just organized me physically. I was the sort of kid who, you know, when I did a somersault in my crib, my parents took me to the doctor and said, we have a weird one here. In a family of intellectuals, we have this apparent jock. What shall we do? So, yeah, I think I needed to move. And I think they'll find out at some point that dancers are really just serotonin-deprived youngsters. And that I don't know anyone who makes a conscious choice to be a dancer. You are a dancer in your heart. You have the temperament and spirit of a dancer, and then you need to dance. So that's what happened. I don't even think I was all that good at 7 or 8 when you're supposed to be
right,
shiny and brilliant. And 8 years in, I got really good.
And, you know, a lot of circus people don't like structure, which is why they end up doing circus, and they sort of like to be independent and, you know, find their own unique voice. Did you like the structure of ballet while you were doing it, or did you find that confining?
I loved it. I loved it. I still love it. I still either teach class or take class every day.
Nice.
And not, to me, class is not at home with a bar and a mirror. That's at home with a bar and a mirror. And then the urge to vacuum becomes overwhelming. I really, really like the structure of class. I think it's necessary if you're going to do any of these art forms, really. Because what circus had needed, by the time I came into it, I thought, oh, it needs a super disciplined setup, you know?
What was the first circus you saw?
I saw Ringling as a kid.
At Madison Square Garden, presumably?
Yeah, at Madison Square Garden. I was on Broadway at the time. I was a teenager. And
you were on Broadway, like in a show on Broadway?
In a show.
Oh, what show were you in?
My first show was Brigadoon. It was
Brigadoon.
I know. It was a fantasy come true. I got the show. I was 17. I was on Broadway at 18.
I want to hear that. Let's back up a little bit.
Yeah,
I would
let's
like
back
to hear
up.
First, you jumped way ahead. I'm like more into asking
childhood.
Yeah.
How was childhood? It was awesome. Thank you.
But so you were doing ballet, but were you studying other dance forms as well, or was it really ballet?
It was all ballet for a while, and then I happened upon the American Dance Machine, which was run by a woman named Lee Theodore, who was a Broadway performer and innovator, and she had wanted to reconstruct great dance numbers from shows that had either made it or not, but things that people had forgotten about, and pulled together everybody who'd ever choreographed anything and made a living archive, let's call it. It was very brilliant. It was in the 70s, and the ballet teacher I wanted to take with was in that building kind of thing, you know, and then there was Lee Theodore. I was all of 15. And people came through there that, you know, it was Robbins and, you know, Peter Gennaro and Agnes DeMille, and people came in and set these numbers. And then I was an apprentice, you know, I got little parts here and there and, you know, did, you know, a show or two. I got to do, she needed, you know, 6 girls to back up Cheetah Rivera in America, and they put hoop earrings on me and said, you are now Spanish.
Oh, was that right?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And so I was, you know, 16
like
years old.
Girl.
Oh yeah. No, and they no wig or anything. They just like, you'll do, you can do the choreography, you know? So, and that was Peter Gennaro, you know, whom I knew then. So it just, I was a lucky camper. I was in a great place. And DeMille,
how did that lead to?
Well, DeMille was still around, cast Brigadoon with her original choreography.
Wow.
And she hired me. basically to do it. And then I had to, you know, at the dance machine, we had to sing and we studied Shakespeare. I mean, it was like a classical education in the arts, and another classical education, strict ballet class, all day long, choreography workshops. I mean, it was a big thing. I don't remember. I know I went to school and I apparently have a high school degree, but I don't remember any of it. It's really, really vague. And my parents trusted me to, you know, get on the bus and,
oh my gosh.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine? The 70s. I mean, it wasn't better then. It was a dangerous world, but they just thought, you know, I didn't lie to them. I told them what I was doing. They got a kick out of it and they let me do it.
So, but by the time you're like 17 or 18 and already landing a Broadway show, were you sort of like, oh man, what next? Or were you just like more Broadway shows?
I had no idea what I was doing and no context. This is, you have to understand the dark ages before we knew what other people did. So I just did the thing that was in front of me. Somebody said, well, how did you get into show business? And I thought, show business? Am I in show business? I had no idea. And when I got in Brigadoon, I covered... I was the swing, which I didn't know what that meant, but I thought, I'll take that job, sign that contract, and go on the road. And I covered 8 dancers and 5 singers.
Dang.
And I was a teenager, and I knew nothing. So I sat there in the first rehearsal, and they said, take notes. And I thought, oh, I will take notes of the person who looks like they know what they're doing. Of course, it was one of the leads, and I didn't cover her, but I didn't know that for, you know, 2 days. So it was just, I just learned as I went, and then I developed a reputation in the business of being a really fast study. I mean, there were a gazillion good dancers and good singers and great-looking, you know, broads and whatever, and people who speak, you know, present themselves well, but I really could be thrown into a show and learn it in, you know, in a couple of days. I once learned to tap dance in 2 days because it was for Tommy Toon and I had to learn it. And I thought, well, I didn't ask the one important question. Do you tap?
Right.
I just thought, well, you look right. 2 people said she will learn the show in 2 days. We have to, you know, put
what
somebody on.
What show were you doing with Tommy Toon?
My one and only.
Oh, wow.
So I really was the smart one, I think.
That's
you know,
so cool.
I was desperately trying to be the beautiful one, but I was the smart one. So that's how that went. And these were great times. I mean, and I did Annie with Peter Gennaro, who I had met earlier. I did, you know, a bunch
at
of television.
The palace, though, was it the?
I did it on the road. I did the last national company, which still had a lot of the Broadway people in it, but it was a very unlikely show for me.
Was it your first time, like, really traveling around the States was with these shows, or had you?
Yeah.
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 Was it weird? Was it fun? Like,
no, it was great.
It was great.
It was great. I still love, you know, a suitcase in a hotel room kind of thing. That's my idea of vacation. It's like, I'll just go to the hotel over there. I think that's part of the temperament. Mm. Aspect is, if you don't like that sort of thing, it's not for you. When I'm training young people now, I encourage them to take a road show. You know, maybe not the worst show in the world. It's like, no, go on the road with Marvel. Get that. See if you like that.
Yeah.
Because if you don't like that, this isn't, you have to like being uncomfortable and being unprepared. And feeling like, I'm going to do my show tonight, I just warmed up on a bus or on the back of a motorcycle, you know, or something. You know, I'm just like stretched and I don't know the stage. I don't know these props. I don't know where my stuff is. Lovely to see all of you, this audience. You know, I mean, you have to be in such a good mood about these things. You can't be a cranky traveler.
Yeah, particularly if your tour is like new place, like every couple of days.
I once, the Annie tour was a first class tour, which devolved immediately into a bus and truck tour. And it was one nighters and, you know, the worst hotels, and then an occasional mistake, a nice hotel, you know,
right.
They would get it wrong. And I had set out for 6 months and we got our notice on opening night. The movie had come out and they couldn't compete with the movie.
Mm.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
Early 80s. So, you know, you have to be in a good mood about that, too. You're like, oh, okay. You know, I would like to think that I was calculated and ambitious and well thought out, and I was none of those things.
It just happened.
Things happened, and I think I made, you know, I made some good choices. I liked things that were authentic. The only thing in the back of my head ballet-wise was I wanted to work with someone who I felt was the real deal, and I thought that would either be Martha Graham or Agnes DeMille. And that's maybe the only abstract idea, but also because they had written and I was, you know, super literate and a person of books and, you know, pre-internet, again, you don't really know, but there was a record of the two of them and of their friendship. Mm-hmm. And
that would be a good musical.
Yes.
The two of them.
Thank you. You heard it here first.
Yes. 1% net profit of whatever.
Yeah, exactly. I always like to be where the small bearer. Money is. I've also had a literary magazine, you know, so I clearly, you know, poetry and ballet, I think maybe puppetry will be next, you know.
Ballet was, my background is musical theater and I grew up doing ballet, tap, jazz, you know, and like the occasional hip hop class where, you know, it's not really hip hop, but it's like jazz hip hop. But ballet was always my, like, I just dreaded ballet. But I took it always because it was such a good foundation for everything else.
Yeah.
But it always surprises me when people are like, I loved ballet. I wish I loved ballet. But I was just always like, you know, tuck your butt under.
Oh, if you're not, you know, an utterly perfect ballet specimen.
Yeah.
You go through a lot of hell. I think I was oblivious to a lot of it. I was just kind of going along doing the thing that I liked. I don't think my chances were great. I mean, I think I just, you know, I hit the right movement and the right time where, and I think DeMille also liked the look of me and thought, you know, and my training was really solid. My teacher was Fokine. I mean, this was New Jersey and I lucked into, you know, somebody who had a lineage. I mean, her uncle choreographed the original Dying Swan, which was not actually Swan Lake, but it was the precursor to Swan Lake, what Swan Lake became, Mikhail Fokine. And her mother was in one of the first Nutcrackers. And,
oh, wow.
And she was part of, you know, one of the incarnations of Ballet Russe. And, you know, so her stories became when I was at Mariinsky, you know. I mean, right. You know, so... this was who I had. And then when I went into the city, I mean, they were rock stars and people had the teachers that there were, you know, David Howard, Richard Thomas in those days, the father of the actor, Doug Wassell. They had little studios, so the real estate was available in those days. The city was different and you could have a big studio with a ballet bar and a mirror. And somehow or other that was paid for. By 1980, it was almost completely over. It really, because the real estate picture changed, you couldn't rent these big spaces, and they started to go out and they started to combine. So they became these enormous sort of dance factories. Mm. And what happened is, in my mind, the training changed. I mean, it's very, very hard to learn ballet in a big space with 75 people in your class.
Yeah.
And I had so much personal attention. I mean, I used to take Valentina Perislavik's class, impossible name to pronounce. I probably didn't get it right that time either. But she was Nureyev's teacher. Mm-hmm. I mean, and there she was with her fur pieces and her earrings and her liquid eyeliner and her cane and would say, baby, come here, you. Put body and fiat right here, you know, and just like, you know, in a class with 15 people in it.
Right, well, you really have to be like, I am doing these movements because everyone's watching me.
Well, you also had to not get thrown out. Like right. If you couldn't handle the class.
How you get thrown out? God.
Well, yeah, they could uninvite you basically. Yeah. But these were open classes and I just went. Like, we used to come into the city just to get the schedule and then, like, you know, look at all the, you know, young dancers that I knew. I mean, this was, somehow we care about what was authentic, even though I don't know what context we had for that either.
But, so now I'm getting a sense of you being very multidisciplinary. Did poetry come next or did circus come next?
Poetry was always there. For 25 years, I had a literary magazine with my brother, my late brother. And he died in 95, and I took it over. I was sort of the every third, you know, issue Brooklyn editor, I think, at that time. And then I sort of did it in his honor. And then I've continued. I only stopped right about the time I started The Warehouse, because that I couldn't do both.
What was the name of the magazine?
Fishdrum.
Fishdrum?
Mm-hmm.
Is there any kind of particular focus that it
was? It was Buddhist. It had a lot of beat poets. My brother was a Buddhist priest and a poet himself, and knew Philip Whalen and, you know, some of the interesting people. And Philip was, you know, part of Allen Ginsberg and Gallery Six and all of that crowd. And he, yeah, somehow that was his crowd, and then it became my crowd. When my brother died, the poet Philip Whalen was someone that he looked after, and I inherited part of the looking after of Philip. So I was very involved in that, in creating something called Poets in Need, which was like my first nonprofit endeavor. I didn't found it, but I sort of came into it as we were really getting it together, and funds that Ginsberg had left for Philip wound up starting this. It's a long, complicated story, but anyway, so it just got me very involved in the poetry scene, and I did about 20 Perfect Bound books. Wow. I mean, they're not really magazines. I mean, they're books. I did a bunch of tributes, one that has, like, you know, Ferlinghetti in it, and, you know, and Diane De Prima and all of the, you know, remaining beats.
Was it the
first
thing you were managing in that sense, where you had gone from being somebody who was, like, an artist and dancer to somebody who was, like, facilitating that work?
I think I was always like that. My father brought us up, you know, we did math at the dinner table and we all had to work in his office, you know, so it was, I had the kind of upbringing that I don't see too much of anymore, where it's a different kind of family involvement. It wasn't based around TV or
right.
a thing. We read, and it was a house of books and ideas, and, you know, on the weekends you went to the museum, and I had that kind of upbringing. Mm-hmm. So I never felt anything was a step away. During the time that I was working on the poetry magazine, I had left dance. I was injured, and, you know, I did 20 years sort of beginning to end. So at the old age of 27, I stopped dancing, and my feet were, you know, shot from all the point work. And, you know, I actually wound up doing point in my one and only had point in it. And then the last show that I did was called Nonsense.
Uh-huh.
And I played the original ballerina nun.
Oh, wow.
So I was doing fouettes, you know, and point, and a habit.
Did that show last long?
I think 30 years or something like that. I mean,
it's
still running.
Right,
I did 3 years of it.
Where did
off
you,
Broadway?
It was off Broadway. Okay.
Yeah, but it was a big hit, and then
That show last long? Yeah, 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's still going on. Three years was enough. I personally was not enjoying that show at all.
Oh, yeah.
It was a comedy show,
a funny ballerina. Yeah, this is like that one song I really know from it. That's like the really funny song
Nonsense.
That everyone uses. Yeah.
Is Heather forming that one? Or no? I Just Want to Be a Star.
Yes, I Just Want to Be a Star. It's like the audition song that everyone used.
No, I was the novice. I was playing the.
Did you have any kind of like crisis after you finished dancing? A lot of people who we interview who finish the thing they've been doing as a child, you know, in their mid-20s are like, oh God, what now? Or did the poetry and other things just naturally take over?
I've been told I was very cranky at that moment because I was sort of post-surgical and sort of thought I would go back and do my show and then wasn't walking well and all of that. I thought, well, and I couldn't, you know, bend my big toe for 10 years or something like that.
Just from the point?
I'd had some surgery on the toe, and then it, you know, cut through some nerves and, you know, the thing that happens.
Ugh.
And the surgery wasn't even, it was over like a suspected melanoma. And then I had many, many like infections. I mean, dance, you know, there's a whole book to be written just from the ankles down, dancer feet. But, you know, by the time I finished, I didn't have any toenails. I mean, like my feet were just a mess. And I think I was happy to be off of them, honestly. And I was doing this job and that job and was kind of excited to do different things. And again, I never looked at it in the bigger picture because I was just reading. You know, I wasn't like going, what are other people doing? I just thought, oh, well, here I am again, thinking of the next thing. And I just took I said yes to everything that came my way. I wound up answering the phone for a friend of a friend in her office. And then I wound up sort of co-running a cosmetic company, like out of and that's where I learned about business. A little bit from my dad and, you know, when we were like three, we would be like alphabetize the bills, you know, as soon as you knew the alphabet, you know, that was like the first job. The pay rates were terrible. So, you know, came to this sort of foundering company, very interesting, group that was trying to do, well, not trying, I guess they're still around. They were doing, it was after the 1990 census came out, and they thought the world is getting a lot darker, and apparently cosmetics are not made for 75% of the world. Mm. That is not Caucasian. So that was the project, was to make some, was to have a different theory on how makeup, you know, because it sits differently on dark skin, right, and on black skin and all of that. So I thought, oh, okay, I guess I will be doing that. Learned a lot. A couple of life disasters later, of not having to do with that, but a few personal disasters later, took up flying kind of by accident.
Flying trapeze.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had, in between there, you know, disclaimer, I did want to be a clown. I had a street clown act.
How did you even know that you wanted to be a clown?
It was like a poetic idea, I think. and I was I like costumes and I like whatever. And I somehow came up with this whole thing. I thought that apparently this is a clown. And just had a little circus lust going and wasn't sure what to do about it. Well, yeah. And Big Apple and was traveling a whole lot at that time. So I'd seen some circuses around the world and was starting to establish a presence in France. And I still actually have a presence there. I just don't go there very much. I have a little apartment. That was like and now I'm going to take my clown out for a walk kind of thing. And I just thought, well, I'll try it. And I like to do things that put me on that edge.
Yeah, you go from beating up your feet in ballet to beating up your hands in flying.
Well, yeah, the flying happened. I hope this is a really long podcast because these stories are long. But the flying happened. It was a really strange thing. I was in another part of my life in Guanajuato, Mexico, for something called.
I feel like every time this story, you're like, I have a place in France. Now I'm in Mexico. I'm like, what?
Well, I was there for something called State of the World Forum, okay, which was an international think tank of sitting around thinking big thoughts, and this was about. This particular one was about crises of the spirit in terms of Latin America. Mm. Okay, so I am there with a group called Social Venture Network. Don't even ask. There I am. And kind of as like a little bit of a tag along. Like someone said, well, you should come to this. This would interest you. And we're going to, you know, meet, you know, Vicente Fox and, you know, Indira Gandhi or whatever. And I said, okay, well, I'll go. Let me find something to wear that's not a clown outfit. And I wound up in a group of 700 people sitting next to Sam Keen. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, very interesting fellow. I remember, he'd written an inadvertent bestseller, Fire in the Belly. Very interesting guy, blah, blah, blah. Mrs. Sam Keen sitting next to him, sort of hitting him with a newspaper saying, and everything was fine until he set up that fucking trapeze in the backyard. Can I say that on,
yeah,
you can bleep.
Oh, yeah.
So I was, talking to the person on the other side, and then I come back to Sam, like, what trapeze? What do you mean trapeze? And he said, oh, well, yeah, I went to circus school when I was, in my early 60s, and I have a trapeze in the backyard, and I thought, and he said, and I'm doing a workshop, and he kind of dared me. He said, 6 weeks from now, I'm going to be at Omega in Rhinebeck, and you should come. I said, well, don't ask twice because I'm already packing in my head. Like, what am I going to wear? And I went and I did like a week workshop and, kept the relationship with Sam. I know him really well. He's now well into his 80s and still takes a swing and still catches. He's a pretty awesome guy.
Oh my God.
So he wrote a book called Learning to Fly. And, I met Peter Gold, who's a flyer and had worked at Ringling. And, I was brilliant on my first day of flying, and then I sucked for like the next 2 or 3 years. It takes so long to learn, and ballet doesn't make you an automatic good flyer. It makes you a pretty flyer. Mm. So I never really got anywhere. I was almost 40, and I wasn't like going for the triple. I liked flying. I got a little carried away with it. I wound up in a situation where I had a house with a rig in the backyard, like you do. And wasn't getting what I wanted out of it, because when you have a rig, you're facilitating all the time. You don't actually fly. And I couldn't figure out why it wasn't any good at it. I have the same two tricks that I've been doing for, forever, and they're not that great. It looks nice in the video or in the pictures look good, but I didn't really have like a dynamic swing, and I didn't have the strength. And I thought, am I just too old? And then I thought, no, I haven't. I've as good as the people that I had worked with, the situation that I had trained in wasn't how I wanted to train. Mm. So it really made me think, you know, and also it was, they were all the kind of situations where people give each other notes and like lateral notes, you know, like the person next to you goes, I think you broke early. And you're thinking, who are you? You know, I'm used to like only responding to the person, you know, I'm used to never speaking in a class right. And I thought, this is so ingrained in me. I can't do this. So I was sort of looking.
And not giving someone else a note. Like that's what you always.
Oh my God.
Like
well, that gets you fired.
Right.
It gets you fired. I kept thinking, you're fired. Wait, right. It's a workshop. You know,
why are you telling me?
And these were all, a lot of the workshops were, you know, about fear and about, you know, there was really interesting sort of personal journey type workshops, as certainly when Sam was involved, because you know, he also wrote a book called Your Mythic Journey, you know, and it's all about your personal mythology and, you know, protege of Joseph Campbell and all that. So I thought, again, I never think these things out and make a big master plan, but I just had in my head that there was a different way to train people who wanted to do circus that more resembled what I had done without going to Montreal and going to a conservatory, because clearly I was, you know, well and getting into my 40s and thinking, this is, you know, I looked at like, how does one get into the Cirque du Soleil school? Oh, well, let's say I'm 20 years too old to start with, and I can't do any of these things. Well, that's not going to happen.
Had you done it at 18, though, all that dance is like exactly what they're looking for.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I was a little, I was also dissatisfied in some of the flying that I had seen. I thought, my God, they need ballet. I mean, it's like somebody needs to be telling everyone how to stand and how to, you know, present themselves mm-hmm. and where, you know, to get their ears back over their shoulders and right. all the things that I truly care about. So in and about that, I met a couple of people, some of whom panned out and some of whom didn't, but in the beginning stages of what became Circus Warehouse was I did not want to do it alone. I wanted partners and I wanted a scene. Again, it's wound up being more what I was sort of advised to do to begin with, which was to be the charismatic front person, you know, and stop trying to do all the, you know, standing on the board and serving bars, you know, like actually get out there and sell the thing that you believe in. So I've mostly done that, although I do teach the ballet because I, you know, it's like every finger is important right. to me. And I
Adam Kukler is a good friend of ours.
Ah, he's my student.
And he was like, because he knows that I dance. He was like, come take ballet with me. I'm taking ballet. Because, you know, we saw his hat juggling act and we filmed him in the subway.
Which you did a great job giving him that vocabulary.
Yes. And we were talking about it. I was like, wow, Adam, you really, it's so dancey. I love it. It's like you're hitting these movements and you're really tying it lyrically to the piece. And he's like, yeah, I've been taking ballet with Susie at Circus Warehouse. You should come with me.
Then
I moved. I know. So I think the next time he's in town.
But Lindsay has taken a class at Circus Warehouse because when we first started dating and Lindsay didn't know anything about the circus, like nearly 4.5 years ago, I was like, you can't go see all these circus shows without doing any kind of circus.
Then you have no appreciation.
Right, and feeling the pain.
Right. So she did flying trapeze.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Circus Warehouse.
I was really
Who
bad.
Was the teacher?
Ooh, I don't know.
Was it
like
Miguel?
He had kind of long hair. Like,
Stuart? Blonde?
He wore a bow tie.
Younger guy.
Stuart.
It was like a very beginner, like a beginner
yeah.
level class.
Yeah, it was like the beginning.
Stuart is awesome.
Yeah, he was great. And of course, Josh gets up there and is, you know, doing amazing. And then I get the, I was like, oh my, but it is hard.
It's very hard.
It is painful.
Yeah.
And it is high. But it feels so good when you have accomplished it. And you're like, I did that.
It's a big journey for anybody, whether it's, you know,
yeah.
going to be your life work or not. It's
like,
still, you know, we have Miguel Cáceres teaching there now, and he was, you know, he's a really authentic guy. He's, you know, the most beautiful form, the most, you know, his catchers would say, you just put your hands out as your day of work, because Miguel does it the exact same way each time. He's a really specific old school guy. He trained his family. He's, you know, when he went to see when I went to Ringling with him some years ago, he actually went down into the ring because he had trained the girl who did the triple a while back, and he didn't like that she missed the first one. He didn't like the timing. He went into the ring to call it during a show, and I thought, and no one stopped him, yeah, you know, because right. he has so much stature, all, you know, 5'3" of him, and you know, he's wearing a, you know,
looks like he belongs there.
Oh, right. And everyone knows him, you know. So he went and he's like, "Okay, honey, let's give you the timing. Let me call your break," you know. And I'm thinking, like, "Oh my god!" You know? Like, if someone told me that story, I wouldn't believe it. But indeed, he did, and cares very much about. You know, proper training and about a lot of the things I do. I didn't start with Miguel. I lucked into him eventually. There's a representation from all different sorts of fields at the warehouse. I have elite gymnasts teaching. I've had like Dave Durante, I've had Matt Cusick, Ken Berkeley, like people who have, you know, big, legit, you know, like either Olympian or almost Olympian or trained for the Olympics kind of credits. I've worked with, there are a couple of dancers my age, approximately, you know, my era, who teach there, who also do other things. Javier Zuhl, who's not quite my age, but he worked with Graham. She brought him here from Mexico. He's one of the great modern dancers around today, but he also does like a back contortion act that you've never seen anything like that. It's his native dance. It's like he learned it from insects. I mean, it's really something. So people like that, I have like Matt Baker, who's a dancer of my generation, a Broadway style dancer, but he did Kidam mm-hmm. also. So we had, and as a character actor. So like, they're super legit. And then I have like the, what I like to call, you know, sort of the tattooed, punky, interesting hair color crowd who came to circus in a different way.
Yeah.
You know, a little more the other coast, a little more experimental, probably a lot more fun. We're not the cool school. I mean, for sure we're not, but there's an element of that because I think it's necessary and informative.
Like the pro high level yeah. school. I mean,
that's what I want it to be.
Yeah.
I was like, when people come and say like, "Oh, I'm a circus freak and I just want to do like circusy things." I'm like, "Have I got a school for you? Not this one."
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Because, like, I want to go spinning poi. It's like, great.
You know, there's such a range of things that people do, but I want them all to also be on the trampoline.
Yeah.
And to have, everyone has to take ballet. Well,
can you talk a little bit about thinking, like, once Circus Warehouse had started and you started hiring coaches and it became a thing, what your general thinking and planning and strategy was in recruiting really good coaches and, like, creating a program, and how do you pick what classes to have, and just the going from, like, okay, I got a space and I got some equipment and I got me and a few teachers, to, like, really having a thing that's running?
This would have all been better with a more solid business plan. I didn't do it that way. It was all catching up because it happened. It was like business in an emergency, and let's make the thing work. But as I figured out who worked well with this and who didn't, my best asset is the ability to talk people into things, which I've been told that. I didn't know that, but there was a conversation I witnessed between Arturo Padilla, who's, you know, Mr. I'd seen him throw the quad. I used to, like, stalk him in France at Cirque du Vert, like, go and watch him every night and be like, "Is he going to make the quad?" She made most of them. And he was talking to Dave Durante, who's 2008 Olympics U.S. team. And they're admiring each other and saying, "Well, what brought you here?" And he's like, "Susie talked me into it." "What brought you here?" "Susie talked me into it." I was like, "Oh, well, I wrote Arturo a letter." I mean, I don't know him from anything. I wrote yeah. him a letter and I said, "Well, you must get these all the time." And he said, "I do, but I liked yours. I'm coming." And I thought, you know, and then he stayed a month, you know, so it was just like to do a workshop. I think I'm a, it's just talent doesn't make you a good teacher, of course, as we know. And also, it's a lot about temperament, too, and mm-hmm. who's going to give people the right things. And I think I have huge opinions about training and how training should happen. And I've made a few mistakes along the way and had, okay, this doesn't exactly represent us. But for the most part, I just kept my eyes open. And when I see something that looks good, I grab it, you know. I mean, Miguel had come a couple of times, and then there was a day that that job was available, and he came that day. I mean, I said, well, that must have been really a convincing phone call. If you could, would you take this job? And he says, what time you need me there, honey? I was like, okay, I guess I said it the right way. And then never, and it's like 4 years later and hasn't left. So right. Commutes the other way to Florida. So I think that some of it is that, and you have to romance people and keep them. You have to keep your good people. So yeah. That's, you have to make work for them and make it so that they don't go anyplace else. You can have them sign their life away, but people will do what they want to do. So you just have to make a good situation. They have a lot of space. I don't tell people how to teach. I'll rein them in a little bit if it's like, too much conditioning, let those people on the equipment or something. But I don't give anybody, I don't hand anybody, this is how you're going to teach this class. I hire people, I trust them. They're on a really long leash. Excuse me, just one second.
Oh, that's okay.
He's not going to talk at all. And then they all have businesses where they do private lessons. They take the money themselves. They have their own insurance, for that. We take a small piece of it. So, like, they can, eke out a living. It's really hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard. You can't say, well, you have one class a week, but you can only teach here, because then it's not prestigious for us. So I get a lot of crap about that from everybody, you won't lend me your, contortion teachers or whatever. I'm like, no, we're the only place in New York that teaches legit, 2-hour extreme stretch through, extreme contortion classes. And we have the best people, and I won't pimp them out anywhere. Again, it's not a popularity contest. I feel really strongly about the way we train people, and we turn great people out. I mean, if we hadn't done that, then I would say, okay, then I don't know what I'm talking about. But I feel really satisfied that they come out as great generalists, mm-hmm. which is the best you can do if you're training adults. Mm-hmm. We're not training kids. Mm-hmm. So they're not going to be best in show, but they're going to be that guy you want to hire because he can also do that thing over there. Like, he can cover the dance number, and he can do, double back on whatever piece of equipment. And if you need him to learn a new skill or need her to learn a new skill, she'll do it. Mm-hmm. So, like, the movie that's the Greatest Showman movie that's coming out is crawling with the warehouse because they need, oh, and can you do this? And can you do that? And can you double for this one? And, so we did all the flying, like trapeze flying and stuff.
I feel like I should have looked this up before the interview, but are your classes mostly just like you can study one thing, or do you have anything that's kind of like a more general track where you do it for a period of time and it's like an intensive?
Oh yeah. No, we have, it's a professional program, is about a third of what we do. Just sort of, if you're breaking up the business, another third is recreational people, but they're serious athletic practitioners. They're not like, oh, let's just go and, the kids from the block and do whatever. They're like people who do CrossFit and stuff, who want to do circus in that way. And then the program, we have about 30 people in it at the moment. It varies, and we make them a program, and we make it every month. We look at it, we review it with them, and they have to take ballet, stretch, and conditioning. Mm-hmm. And the conditioning is really tough. It's not for lightweights. We audition them in that class, in one of the conditioning classes, and my ballet class, not to see if they have any skills, but to see if we kill them first. Right. If they can't make it through the audition, then we're like, okay. Because just, I don't care how many pull-ups someone can do. I just care if they, they're not dead, and they listen to what I told them to do, even if they don't have any ballet. It's okay. Put your hand on the bar. No, put it there this way. Okay, that looks good. I teach ballet in a really practical way. It's not like super dreamy and, metaphors of flowers and grandparents and things. It's like, no, just put your foot there,
How do you hold your hand when you do ballet? Because I see so many people, you do the finger.
This is playing very well in audio only.
One day you'll come to my class and you'll see how the hands go. I think the fingers have, all five of them have a different personality and relationship to each other. So as long as you're pushing the air about, I'm good with that.
Good job.
You can come to class, and
you won't kick me out?
No, absolutely. No, I never kick anybody out of class unless they... Well, no. Have I ever kicked anybody? A few people have stomped out. But,
oh, really?
Yeah. Well...
It happens.
That happens. I think, yeah.
There's an article, I don't know if you saw it in the New York Times, maybe last week. We were going to talk about it on the pre-show to this episode about a lot of these acting schools that were in Chelsea and Soho, and sort of like you said, back in the 80s, being able to like take over these spaces, and then, you know, rents go up, and they're competing also now against like NYU, which has an acting program. So I'm wondering, this is sort of a two-part question. Do you see a scenario in which Circus Warehouse becomes accredited with a university and it's more of a bigger program? Or on the flip side of that, do you see struggles with similar kinds of things where you have issues of rent or competing against like lots of other smaller programs? Just like sort of what is the scene and how does it compare in that way?
I think because Circus is changing so rapidly and we didn't count on things like, well, there's no more Ringling,
right?
You know, and that Ringling has now... You know, it's Feld still exists, so there are different sorts of shows, and we keep having to sort of regroup and even retrain. Like, oh, okay, now we're all going to do this. I'm having someone come in to teach stunts soon, because which I never really thought of. But I went, well, since Marvel comes here every 3 months to our school and auditions people, we actually need to know that, you know? And I would never, that was not in the game plan, you know, 7 years ago. I am not interested in being accredited. I'm somebody who, you know, eked out a high school diploma, you know, by accident and flunked gym, you know, so I'm not an academic. I'm not a theoretician. I'm a really practical, almost Buddhist approach to these things, which is that I do the thing that's necessary to do at that time. And I like that I can make a quick change and not have to, you know, ask a board. I mean, my biggest nightmare would be to report to a board.
Right.
Is that I just, you know, so I didn't, as I said, I didn't do a nonprofit. It's extremely expensive and nitpicky to do an accredited school. I mean, of course it's happening and it looks good, but I look at the roster of places like that and they're not better teachers than we've got. I find even in important schools, let's call them, there are people that are teaching things that are kids that are in their 20s that have no business teaching a program. Mm. You know, I'm saying it. I'm sorry for everybody that I've now offended, but you know, my teachers, I mean, the average age is 40 something. Mm. And we go, you know, and even in my program, I have someone who's 63. It's like, why shouldn't I train him?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he also, you know, this is someone who was catching and, you know, in recreational schools. And I thought, why shouldn't he catch big tricks? Why shouldn't he take ballet? Why not make him a better, you know, a better practitioner and a better, you know, example for this business?
Yeah.
So it's not, we're not just on a mission to like churn out 20-year-old nimble gymnasts. They usually come to us with gymnastics and some ballet or something, you know, something where, even if it's violin, just something where they've studied and they know how much they're going to give up for this. And then those people are going to, the people that we bring in are the ones that are going to determine what Circus is. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not, you know, I'm not the figurehead in that way where I'm going to say, I'm just going to give them the tools to be creative. We did a student show last night. We don't make them their acts. We don't make them their costumes. We don't choose the music. We go, you know, really? Are you going to put that on your head? I mean, or something to that. Or we like to say, you know, Susie's crotch notes. That is entirely too much crotch. Or where is your crotch? You know, I mean, you know, it's like it's one or the other. You know, it's very ballet. It's always to be like, well, how's that package working out for you? I'm so fired. no, but just things like, you know, We tweak it, we look at it, we help them, but I want creative people because they're gonna, we had a kid in the show who does whacking and he did like whacking and lyra. And I was like,
whacking, for those who don't know, is like sort of like Vogue style dance. Not Vogue, but it's dancing with your arms flailing and
yeah.
craziness.
It's, and this kid is completely brilliant and interesting and he's informing us. You know, I never thought that this was a possibility. And then he just has, you know, he has Susan Wojtycki, who's taskmaster at, you know, on Lyra and banging out that technique. And he's in ballet and we're just, you know, we're just bringing him all together somehow and you know, making it, turning him out with the skills to do the stuff that he wants. And there's, you know, circuses and everything at the moment. So we're not... The goal isn't always one of these big circuses. We have trapeze flyers flying in a bunch of them at the moment. Our first flyer went to Ringling. We've had flyers all over the place because they come, because they're, they present themselves well and they look good in the air and they've got solid tricks. But, you know, that's really the end of it that I care about, mm-hmm. is the training. That's where I thought the lack. I think there's a huge imagination out there. And I'm not worried about that for mm-hmm. the future. I think that there are a lot of thinkers out there of you know, plotters, you know, and interesting minds, you know. Yeah.
I want to ask you about the scene in New York at the moment and if you think it's growing or contracting in New York in particular, as far as circus goes.
I think it's in fits and starts. I mean, it's like sometimes it feels like everybody's interested in circus, you know, movie coming out. There's so much talk about the Windows and Bloomingdale's are circus themed. I don't know that necessarily makes for students.
Right.
I think there's a certain number of people who want to work in that specific way, in that very difficult way, and be part of that kind of community. So I don't know if all of the attention, I don't really know how that works. I mean, because I'm not looking at box office.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly what's happened with animals in circus has changed circus, and it's not going to change back. And that absolutely is what did Ringling in. I wouldn't say that when I was interviewed by any other paper, but I'm saying it now, you know, when people have come to me, you know, what did that? I just thought I'm not going to on CNN say that. But now that the dust has settled, of course that's what did it in. And people don't want to see that.
Yeah.
I personally like the animal acts and, you know, beg to differ on the treatment of animals. I think, you know, it's not, you know, rights for anything, any person or animal is a complicated subject. I mean, but animal welfare, I think the circuses look out for that. But it's not coming back. And that's just, you know, I'm glad I rode an elephant when I could.
Right.
Short window.
Yeah, it was a really short window. But I think it's also just changed. You know, the laws are changing. It's not, you can't, you know, schlep your, you know, leopards from one state to the next. I mean, you can't do it. So that's informing it. Cirque du Soleil is changing what they do. I mean, they're...
Have you been to the NFL experience yet? I'm going to go this week, but they just opened a football-only related experience by Cirque du Soleil in Times Square.
I don't know if that's the apocalypse or it's good.
I don't know either. I don't know. I think it's a separate thing. Like, I don't know if anyone would be like, oh, this is Cirque du Soleil, they do...
Yeah, I'm very curious to see how much branding they do with Cirque
I don't know... The average person doesn't know the difference between tight wire and flying trapeze, and
you know that.
They always say, and is there a net, you know,
right.
and oh, you're up on that wire. I mean, people who know me for years and years still think I do high wire.
Oh.
I'm thinking, well, I could, but that's really hard on the feet. I want to do that again. I don't think, and if I tell, you know, a stranger is that, oh, what do? You interesting looking pink haired person. And I'll say, you know, oh, I run a circus school. And they'll say, I don't know what anything, I don't have any idea what you're talking about.
Yeah,
what does that mean?
Yeah.
Like, I don't even know what question to ask you. People go to school? No, they're just born with a ball on their nose and, you know, like, whatever.
Just do a handstand.
Yeah.
Well, I always find it interesting when people think that Cirque du Soleil and circus is different. People go, well, that's Cirque. Or they think it's the same thing. Oh, yeah, you do Cirque. I'm like, no.
No, circus.
That's a company.
Yeah.
We do circus. Right. So it's the realm of what people know or don't know is amazing. Because people have some touch of theater. You know, like they've been in a school play or, you know, feels relatable. But circus is something that not everyone experiences when they're growing up.
No.
And, like, that's something that we've been talking about a lot on the podcast, especially with people in other areas of the world, is like the ability for kids to have relationship to circus when they're little allows them for when they're adults to be easier ticket buyers or like go
patrons.
Patrons of circus.
For sure.
You know, and how do you restructure that? But it does feel like circus classes are more available.
Well, it's what
circus,
happens. It is more available. It's available on honestly a very low level.
Yep.
So, which is, you know, short classes for the experience with sometimes very talented teachers,
mm-hmm.
but mostly, you know, youngsters like, oh, well, I learned this. Now I'm going to go teach it.
Right.
And I see a lot of stuff and I think, oh, my God, you know, it's exactly what I didn't want. But there's a place for that. because people come to us all the time and that we send elsewhere because we think that isn't, they're not going to get through this, but they might really like that thing over there. You know, sometimes somebody will call up and they're like, we want to bring, you know, this number of kids and they're all 6 years old and they're, you know, they all want to get on the trapeze and jump around on the trampoline and like have a, you know, break things. And I think, and I call Bobby at Streb and I'm like, have I got a gig for you? You know, yeah. I'm like, you know, and Streb is, they're super high level in terms of dance. They've had, you know, very knowledgeable people in all parts of what they do, but they're kid party friendly, you know, and I'm thinking like, oh my, you know, kill me now. You know, we certainly do parties. We even do kids parties, but we're just not really set up for
That's not your niche. Mm-mm. Yeah.
No. And I think, you know, and Trapeze School New York, there's certain kinds of things that people are just happier there. We trade people out all the time. Mm-hmm. They lost their space for 3 years. They came into our space. That was one phone call, like when Jonathan Conan was still part of that. And he was just like, Suze, you know, I know this is a weird idea, but could we, if we don't have a space? And I said, the answer is yes. And then we'll work out the details. And it was so smooth. I was like, you know, that, you know, we'd let them keep their culture. We did our thing. You know, we grumbled about each other a little bit and we still,
it worked out
swimmingly. I mean, it was great and humbling for us, for my students. They're like, who are those people? They fly funny. I'm like, companies come in, go clean in the corners. You know, this is like, you know, this is your moment to learn how to behave. Because in my, and also they have a lot to teach us. They do volume. They do things we don't do. You know, they really, they have different ideas about equipment. Mm-hmm. We installed stuff for them that we wound up using after that. They learned stuff from us. We went in with a good attitude. But when I was, you know, being brought up as a dancer, your teachers told you how to be, not just how to dance. And it was a complete education. And to me, that stuff matters a lot. And our students, it's like I'm working on that part. You know, it's not an easy thing. It's a different, you know, inconceivable generation that I think, oh my gosh, how, you know, it's my generation who brought them up in effect. So it's all clearly my fault. But they're, you know, they have different needs and wants and exposures. And I want them to be well turned out and well spoken and kind and, you know, generously interactive and all of that. So we've set things up where you almost have to be like that to be in the space. You can't just be somebody and like, I'm on this point and I have this for an hour. It's like, actually, as a student, you can't do that. You have to share it. And so that immediately is like, oh, okay, well, so then I'll tape you and then you'll look at this and then maybe you can spot me for this. And I think, okay, first step, you know, and second step is, well, you're going to leave this godforsaken area in Queens and, you know, at 9 o'clock or 11 o'clock at night. Where's your group? You know, where's your team? So that kind of stuff that we learned, how to dress, how to, you know, how to be in a show and how to be gracious. There's a picture I posted today of, you know, 20 students of mine doing this show and they're all standing there exactly the same way. And they all like, everybody's like chins are up and they all look so attentive. I was like, okay, well, we got somewhere, you know, that's a big thing to get people to.
Because that's also a lot of like ballet, right? You're always taught to like have
that it's presentational that you're never off stage. And I said, I don't want silly, stupid bows. Bow like your Baryshnikov, you know, why not? And why not aim high?
Oh my gosh, the bows at the at Lincoln Center. Do you know Justin Peck?
Yeah, of course.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I know.
The times we're racing was like mind blowing. It changed my life. I was like, this is incredible. But the bows are just amazing. Like they have like 15 bows and just like always. And like, I was like, wow, that's really like Vince taking
doing
your
a lot
moment.
Of hand gestures.
Sorry, yeah. I mean, for the podcast, this is not great, but you know, they pull the curtain back and they come out, and it was just so nice. I was like, this is great. And then as an audience member, like, I really wanted to give them that moment. And if you don't bow, you don't take it seriously. It's also like taking away something from the audience, right? Because if they enjoyed your work,
it's what I see a lot of times when I see. you know, other performances and out there in the world, and especially lower level stuff, is people bow and they think, oh my God, I was so fabulous. And I'm thinking, well, that's the first one of three. You have to hit that. You have to hit, I got through, you know, I didn't die. And then you actually have to be generous. You have to gesture to the audience and say thank you that you sat through this thing that I worked on and that you gave me, you know, 5 minutes of your life, hopefully three. I like a short act. But and then you have to show humility from your heart and soul. And I actually make them do that gesture. And like, I know it's just like, you know, you're all 6 years old, but this is the thing you have to know is, you know, I was great. Thank you. And I'm humble.
Right.
You know, and it's a good slowing down lesson for them. I had a bunch of six-year-olds this summer. It was a local gymnastics school, and we were doing some collaborations, and somehow I got to be the one who taught ballet to six-year-olds. And I thought, you know, I've never done this. I'm going to maybe before it's too late, I'll try it. And that was their favorite part. I taught them that, and they were walking around going, I'm awesome but humble, and flinging themselves on the floor. And I thought, oh, well, at least, you know, they're going to remember that. Yeah, like, the rest of it, they were so disinterested. I don't want to be a swan. You know, and like, they're all really cranky, but they like the ceremony. I think people, this goes back to something you said in the very beginning, people liked when things are organized. Yeah. And they when you're not, when I come in occasionally, like I, you know, what was I teaching today? Or I'm not teaching, I don't get my act together very fast in class. I can feel the disarray in the students. They love it
when
you're
energy.
Yeah. They don't like when you free associate. They really like when you're, you know, determined and have a plan and stick with your subject. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, for me, like daily class is that thing. You know, and whatever it is that you take.
So I think we're at that time now where we ask our final three questions that everybody gets. So the first one being, has there been a piece of advice, really good or really bad, that has stuck with you for, you know, your life for a long time?
The best piece of advice from a business mentor and old boyfriend, so very special guy, said to me many, many, many years ago that the characteristic of a really smart person is that they know how to make changes.
Mm.
And I think of that a lot. Just when I get married to my own idea, like I have this idea, I immediately try to get divorced. And I just say, maybe I don't think that. You know, even the sound of my own voice sometimes when I teach, I feel like I'm saying that again. Maybe I'm going to rethink that. And that informs me all the time that it's not. That's why, you know, the theory, the planning, it's like, okay, I probably could be better at all of that. It's not art. I'm trying to run a business. But I like to work on my feet, and I like to think that I can change my mind once I've made maybe not a great, you know, decision about something, which invariably you make. And or to be wrong about a person, or to say this one isn't going to learn this, and then say, you know, surprise me. Like, it's such a relief not to have to be right all the time.
Yeah, even that second part of that answer is a very good piece of advice. So the second question we ask, for somebody who isn't in New York City and can't come to Circus Warehouse tomorrow to take a class with you, is there a book or a movie or a show or just any artistic reference that somebody who is a young student of Circus should experience or read or watch?
Well,
could be a poet too.
Circus it's a kinesthetic experience. It's not something you have to put your face in the water, in effect. I'm sorry to mix up all of my metaphors, but it's not something you can learn by that, but if you wanted to understand the romance of it, you know, some of the old circus films inspired me, certainly Trapeze and Greatest Show on Earth and things like that. And this new movie coming out, which I saw already. It's so charming. I mean, it's a little Disney-fied, but it has immense charm. And I really wanted to run home and put on my Barnum outfit and,
really,
you know.
The new Hugh Jackman movie called The Greatest Showman.
The Greatest Showman. Yeah. We went to like the cast screening, and it had charm, and it charmed me. And I, you know, there are days when I think I'm giving up. I'm taking my stuff and going home. I don't know where, how that's going to work, but that's what I'm doing. You know, stomp, stomp, you know. And then I saw this. And I thought, oh, that sparkle that, you know, Hugh Jackman is a wonderful actor. He talks about, you know, making circus and you know, has such care, you know, and reverence for his audiences. And, you know, I think just that. That puts you in the right mood. Mm. You know, then you just have to go to class. You know, it's like there are classes everywhere at this point. I mean, pretty much everywhere. And now that, you know, there's an internet, you can look it up. You know, you can find it and look through people's resumes, make sure they do what they say they can do, and you know that they have real chops.
Yeah. And our last question is: who do you think we should have on the podcast?
You've probably had most of the people that you've had, like Jessica Hentoff.
And, yep. Yes.
And maybe one of the old timers, like Miguel Cáceres, would be fun because his story, you know, coming from Colombia and with his, you know, and his training his family at, you know, his 5-year-old son at Monte Carlo. He's got lots and lots of stories.
I love. We had Elaine Kramer too.
Yeah.
We had her on, and she's
similar multi-generation. Yeah, kind
just of like how presence. Did you learn how to shoot a bow and arrow with your feet? My dad saw a photo, and he's like, "Let's just do this."
Well, some of these stories. I mean, what's really fun is traditional circus people. It's also not. The story is supposed to be as much fun as the actual circus. So, you know, sometimes you think, is that the actual? Well, all right, we'll take that as a story.
Speaking of Big Apple, do you see the guy that throws the quad in that show?
Oh, Ahmed, yeah.
Oh, Mike. Ugh, just, and he got it. We've seen a guy try in Ringling and everywhere else.
Well, he tried at Ringling, I think, too.
I don't know. I haven't seen anybody in Ringling nail it, but then he nailed it the very first time we saw it in Big Apple.
Yeah, and awesome. I was filming it. So I was like, yeah.
I've seen it a couple times, actually.
Probably, it must be us, because every time we go, except for the night at Big Apple, they always miss and they try, you know, 2 or 3 times.
Yeah, the first time I went, he missed and he, you know, I met him after and I know him a little bit, you know, just through the field and he was, oh, you know. And I said, well, I'm coming back with Miguel. And he said, don't tell me when. And then, you know, first time Miguel said, no, honey, the timing. And I was like, don't go in the ring, Miguel. You know? And then it was the second one was such a solid catch that it was, and I was trying to film it. I don't like to film like this because I want to see it. Right. So I sort of had like this, but it's like all over the place. And my camera, I couldn't keep it still because I was, you know, so busy jumping up and down.
Our Instagram, because I was like this. I was like, if he's going to get it, I'm going to get this on film. So I was like, so.
Yeah.
And it's pretty magical. I think he's one of the great flyers flying today. And that act is a beautiful act. It's so pure and it's simple. And the girl does, you know, double pike. Yeah. Like, yes.
Yeah, she's good. She's great too.
She's terrific.
Yeah.
And it's a small act, which I really like.
I love it.
And I like that, you know, the simple costumes. It was so classy. And he's got a, you know, matinee idol look, and which is fun, you know, because nobody really looks like that. You know, he looks so fresh.
Right.
You know, like just with the price tag, you know, under his arm. And I loved that act.
I love it. That would be
and you've
too.
Interviewed Barry Lubin, yes?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, he's super fun.
Yeah, that's good to get a, you know, a coach. We do Salam Awabi.
You should 100% get him to coach at the warehouse, or at least do a guest, you know, coach. But he's, I think, the third episode, and he's originally from Morocco, and like he was just performing acrobatics on the beach, and then an acrobatic troupe like came past like 1 year, and he just left Morocco. And never,
yeah, you know, never that returned. Story.
But same kind of like.
But cool, he coached cool. at Smirkus and NECA.
Yeah, and around.
Yeah,
but
he's, you know, old school. An older man, like really, like you have to learn the basics before you can do, you know, anything.
What's interesting is when you have a lot of people like that, then there's contrary advice as well.
Oh, right.
So you have to be careful who you throw in the mix. Because
there's only 20 masters you can really have teaching
I had
there.
A lovely, lovely guest artist from Dance Theater of Harlem say to me, I would love to teach a dance class here sometime. And I said, well, you know, I always need a sub. I mean, there's always some disaster or other. And certainly he's absolutely beautiful dancer, very articulate. And he said, I teach pure classical Balanchine. And I said, you're fired. I was like, just like, I can't. I just can't, you know? And it was so funny. And I'm thinking, like, it's, you know, wildly talented guy, but we would fight like crazy.
Yeah.
If I was like, this is, actually, if you're teaching my class, this is what I want you to teach. you know, because this is what they're learning and this is what I've told them. So don't tell them, you know.
Right, something totally.
Yeah,
totally.
I mean, Balanchine, you know, genius that he was, really, you know, screwed it up for all of us. Like, you know, like curvy Jewish ladies, let me tell you. Like, I was like, really? Now we can't do this? You know, and it's literally a body type. It's like it has to do with how your legs fall from the hips. I mean, it's so specific.
And the curvature of your, like, back, too.
Yeah.
That's what I would always get yelled at, because I would stick my, I would hold my tailbone out a tiny bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't do a tuck. I don't teach a tuck
because I think it's, I can definitely come
no, because tuck. It's bad for, this is so important for this podcast, but this is the after party. The tuck is just bad for the cartilage. It, like, grinds away at your cartilage. And if you're, I'm
55.
And no, I can say I'm 55 and I still have some cartilage, you know, it's like amazingly, because I sort of rethought it when I went to retrain myself to teach and all that. And I thought, I'm just not going to get into any of that grindy stuff because I need what little I have. Once you're out of cartilage, they have to take it out of your ears. It's very painful.
Yeah.
And quite deforming if you have to have your hair up.
Oh, God.
Oh, so, man.
Yeah.
Well,
with hair down.
Susie, thank you so much for coming.
You're welcome. Oh, my God. It was really fun.
Yes, thanks.
And that was our interview with Susie Winson.
If you like our podcast, make sure to like us on Facebook, subscribe to us on iTunes, rate us on iTunes, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com.
Ooh, nice little jingle.
Thanks.
Stay warm, everybody.
Bye.